Good morning and welcome to the third and final day of the March term of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court would like to welcome students from Beresford High School, Armour High School, and Lennox High School. For those of you that have not already had the opportunity, we have several publications available. The first is a synopsis of the cases that we will be hearing or have heard during this term. It also tells you a little bit about the justices and how the court works. There's more detailed explanation in the blue covered pamphlet as to how the court does its duties in a narrative manner. And then also we have available a short pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. If you have not had an opportunity to pick those up, they are available free of charge in the lobby. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota Appellee versus Briley Piper Appellant. Given the nature of this case, the court has allowed expanded time for oral argument will be approximately an hour and a half. The opening will be done by Mr. Timothy Wrench, is that correct, sir? An attorney from Rapid City will speak for 35 minutes, and then Mr. Craig Eichstead, an Assistant Attorney General from Pierre, will speak for 35 minutes, and then Mr. Patrick Duffy, an attorney from Rapid City, will speak for 15 minutes. Correct, counsel?
Correct.
All right. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court and counsel. Justices, we are going to be called upon in a case like this today to determine whether or not a person who actually killed another person who received life is disproportionate to the fact that someone else who was involved in that killing received death. And in order to understand that more clearly, I'd like to get into the factual background a bit for the benefit of the students and for all involved. March 13th of the year 2000, there were three young men out in Spearfish, South Dakota, who met a young man by the name of Chester Allen Pogue. And they went to his house, and he was being nice to them, and he was being good to them, and he was opening up his house for them. And even though he was being kind, these three decided to take him out and kill him. My client is one of those three. His name is Briley Piper, and he pled guilty for that. A co-defendant named Elijah Page also pled guilty to that. The final co-defendant received a life sentence. His name was Darrell Hoadley. It is our position here today that it is disproportionate for Darrell Hoadley to have received a life sentence while Briley Piper and Elijah Page, in fact, received a death sentence. And in that regard, we are going to be dealing with the following issues, I hope, in the following order. The first one, I would say, would be the proportionality issues, or the issues surrounding whether or not, under our Constitution, under our laws, under our case law, and under our statutes, it is grossly disproportionate for one of these co-defendants to receive life where the others receive death. So the first bundle of issues will revolve around the proportionality. The second issue that I will be dealing with will be the developments in the law concerning Ring versus Arizona and the necessity of charging aggravating factors before a death penalty can be imposed. The final issue that I will be dealing with the subject of prosecutorial misconduct and benefits that we believe were given to a cooperating witnesses that were not disclosed to the defense at the time of the trial. If we look at the proportionality and we look at the state statutes, the federal constitution, the state constitution, and State versus Bonner, this court is called upon to determine whether or not co-defendant proportionality would require that one co-defendant receives a grossly disproportionate sentence as compared to another co-defendant. And in this case, it would be our position that it is grossly disproportionate for Briley Piper, who pled guilty to felony murder, receiving death, whereas the co-defendant, Darrell Hoadley, actually denied his guilt, went to trial, and received a life sentence. If we look at the case of State versus Bonner and look at gross disparity between the sentences, it would be our position here that on remand, when the circuit court judge looked at this matter, the factual findings that were entered in support of the position that Piper still should receive death, even though Hoadley received life, are clearly erroneous. For that, we need to understand a couple of basic things. First of all, there's no dispute in this case that Daryl Hoadley is the one who actually inflicted the death blow upon this poor young man who did not deserve to die that night. In light of that, even though he inflicted these death blows, it was determined by a jury that he should receive life imprisonment rather than death. On the other side of that, you have Briley Piper, who admittedly was involved in all of this and who pled guilty, accepted responsibility, and apologized, and who was not the one who actually killed, although he took part in the killing, receiving death. And it's our position here today that that's grossly disparate under the schemes of our statutes and under the case law of the United States and of the state of South Dakota in State versus Bonner.
Can I ask a question about our standard of review? Now, you mentioned three separate authorities for proportionality for us to use in deciding proportionality. One was the South Dakota Constitution, the other was the Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution, and then you mentioned our statutes.
That's correct.
And under our statutes, as I understand them, the law requires that we do a proportionality analysis on death cases. That's mandatory for us to do that. Is the standard the same under that statute as it is for the Eighth Amendment? Do we use the same standard?
It would be our position that, given the fact that it's a death case, that you're dealing with heightened scrutiny. You still look at the cases to determine whether or not there's gross disparity, and from that standpoint, the standard could be the same. However, under our statute, it's even broader than just proportionality analysis. You look to determine whether it was imposed under passion, prejudice, or undue influence, or things of that nature. And in this case, now that we mention it, it was our position that in the underlying sentence, this death sentence was imposed partially under passion and prejudice, because the court at the time of the sentencing looked up to the ceiling and referred to the victim as though he was looking down from above. So our statute actually provides more protection and different analysis than what would be required under the Eighth Amendment, and it is on that basis that we would be asking you to determine that Briley Piper's death sentence is so grossly disproportionate to Daryl Hoadley's life sentence that his sentence should in fact be life.
To follow up though, then under subsection 3 of our statute, what exact standard should we apply in reviewing proportionality?
Well, I think that you should apply a de novo standard and look at take an intensive and exhaustive review of the case and decide whether or not it's disproportionate based upon what the other defendants received in the co-defendant proportionality. And then you expand it and look at what other people in South Dakota who've been in this pool, this death eligible pool, have received, and see if there is a grossly disproportionate sentence there. It's twofold. It's the facts of the case, which there's no doubt in a case such as this, these are horrendous facts. Nobody should ever have to go through this. But more importantly, you also look at the defendant himself individually to determine whether or not he merits this type of punishment. In the state of South Dakota, if we look at the other people who've been death eligible or who have received the death penalty, they're very different from this young man named Briley Piper. You look at Donald Moeller, for example. You look at the felony convictions that he has, the violent record that he has, the facts of the offense, the fact that he did not benefit from rehabilitation. You look at Anderson, for example, and look at the number of victims. You look at he's increased in age. His personality has been able to be formed. Briley Piper, you have a person who's a young man, 19 years old, no significant record, no prior felonies on his record, exhibited goodness in the past, had done positive, civic-minded things back in his home state of Alaska. Yes, he did something terrible here, and that's unforgivable. But if you look at the proportionality analysis and look at both the facts of the offense and the defendant, in this case, looking at Briley Piper's background under the statute and under the overall proportionality analysis, he's so different from other people who have been convicted of this. He's so young that we would like to think there's a chance at redemption.
Was there any testimony in support of the fact that of his rehabilitation?
No, there was no testimony indicating. We did not present testimony at the time of the sentencing that he could be rehabilitated, frankly, because he's facing a mandatory life without parole situation. But there was evidence in the record from people who knew him about his childhood, about the things
right.
he'd done.
Was there any evidence of, in comparison with the other two defendants, is there any evidence of support for rehabilitation in the matter of Page?
Well, the evidence that was introduced as it related to Mr. Page was such that he had a terrible childhood, was sexually abused, just had a really bad childhood. I don't recall there being evidence of his rehabilitative potential. I know with Hoadley, they brought in a mitigation expert and talked about the things that had happened to him in the past. I don't know that rehabilitation per se was specifically addressed. But what I wanted to say about Hoadley, if we look at backgrounds and if we decide this proportionality analysis based upon the defendant's background, based upon co-defendant's backgrounds, a very strong argument can be made that Hoadley had a much worse background than Briley Piper. Hoadley in the past had been in a situation where he put a knife up to a girl's throat and cut her throat, literally cut her throat. Hoadley in the past had beaten up his mother and called her terrible things. Hoadley in the past had done many more things than Briley Piper had. And the circuit court in this circumstance looked at what Briley Piper had done in the past, even though they were essentially uncharged crimes, and had basically made a judgment call that Piper was worse than Hoadley and more culpable than Hoadley. And it's our position that does not accurately reflect the facts of this case.
Well, how do you account for the fact that Judge Johnson is the only judge that has sat on all three of these cases? And Judge Johnson imposed the death sentence in two of the cases. And then after Mr. Hoadley received a life sentence from a jury, we sent this back to Judge Johnson and asked him to look again and decide if this is fair and right in view of the different sentence that Mr. Hoadley received. And Judge Johnson sent back detailed findings indicating that he still believes that the sentences are proportional.
Well,
and he's the only person that's been continuously involved in this from the beginning.
I agree. And how do I explain that fact? I explain that fact by saying this. When you look at those so-called detailed findings of Judge Johnson, they're not as detailed as you might think. And the findings themselves take Briley Piper and slant the way he looks in a manner that is not supported by the evidence. And those very findings take Darrell Hoadley and slant the way he looks in a manner not only not supported by the evidence, but in a manner very contrary to where the state had indicated Hoadley should be. For example, if you look at Judge Johnson's findings as they relate to Hoadley, mind you, Hoadley, now not that we can parse this stuff up, you know, a whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and we can't very well pull the sugar out of Kool-Aid, but if you look at this whole event out there, and you try to parse what people did, I think we can all agree upon the basic proposition that killing someone is bad, okay? Hoadley killed him. Hoadley put the rock on his head. Judge Johnson indicated that that could have been, because Hoadley wanted to put this young man out of his misery. Well, how can you say that a person who actually killed another person is less culpable than someone who was involved but who didn't actually kill them? How can you say that Hoadley, who admittedly stabbed this young man, is less culpable than Briley Piper, who the court in the original sentence said, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, I don't know that you stabbed him. So the point I'm making here is when the circuit court used all of its information and listened to all the trials and used its feelings on this matter and entered these findings. These findings in a cool room, these findings measured by reasonableness are not supported by the facts in the record. And why Judge Johnson did that, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, are you suggesting then that we should have a per se rule that when three individuals are involved in the same homicide, they must receive the same sentence?
Absolutely not. We should never have a per se rule because it can't take into account all of the different factors that would be involved. But you could make this a per se rule, that when three people are involved in a killing and the person who actually kills the victim gets a life sentence, that the other people involved in the killing should not get a death sentence unless their background is somehow different, unless they've been given a chance under our society to rehabilitate and to reform and they've ignored that chance, or unless there's something really different about them that would cause them to be much, much, much worse than someone else. And I think that at the very least we have to agree that the person who actually killed Chester Allen Pogue is at least as culpable as the other people out there, if not more so. Mind you, this Hoadley, we're not just talking about a reluctant aider and abettor, you know, who's walking along with a knife at his back, doing what his friends say because he's afraid of what might happen. We're talking about somebody who was in there kicking, who was standing on this young man's head in the water. We're talking about the person who supplied the knife. We're talking about the person who said, let's take him out to Higgins Gulch. We're talking about the person who said, I've got your back. We're also talking about the person who, after the fact, kept pictures of the victim's relatives in his cell. The person who, after the fact, kept a knife taken from the victim right next to his bed, who, after the fact, had the dog leash that was used as the bindings upon the victim hanging on his doorknob. So we're not talking about saying, hey, you know, this guy exercised a right to a trial, he got life, therefore everybody else should automatically get life in all cases. That's not it at all. But when you have people who were so equally culpable as these three, so equally culpable that the state, at the time of the trial of the person who gets life, talks about how you can't break this down into the raindrop that breaks the dam or the straw that breaks the camel's back, and that Hoadley was not a robot, that Hoadley did as much as Piper at least, that Hoadley is the one who killed this young man, that Hoadley is the one who supplied the knife. When you have someone equally culpable, if not more so culpable, it's unfair and it's grossly disproportionate to say those around him should get death when he receives life, simply because we feel that one maybe was a leader and one maybe was a man of action. These are all terms. These are all, it's rhetorical almost to try to label these people, especially when we know that Mr. Hoadley is the one who snuffed out that final spark of life. So it's our position here that when you have the killer, when you have the actual killer get a life sentence, and when you have co-defendants who have either similar backgrounds or better backgrounds, it's grossly disproportionate to sentence them to die. Add this to the mix too. Think about this. You know, everybody in this case says, you guys pled him guilty as a tactical decision. You pled him guilty as a tactical decision. Even if we did plead him guilty as a tactical decision, I ask you this. If a person has committed a crime, and we all know they've committed a crime, and they have a right to a trial and they exercise it, you know, we can't really condemn a person for that. We've all got the right to a trial. But at the end of the trial, anybody who stood up in front of judges knows, if you just deny something that is painfully clear and you exercise your right to trial, don't you be asking for a suspended imposition of sentence, because you're not going to get it. There's a difference between a person who knows he's guilty, who exercises a right to trial and is convicted, from a person who says, I'm guilty, I plead guilty, I'll accept it, and I'm sorry for what happened. Even if we believe, even if everybody looking at this record says, well, that's insincere, he did that to save his own shoes, he still stood up to the plate. He still stood up to the plate.
Is there anything in the findings? Judge Johnson referenced the fact that he pled guilty and took responsibility.
Well, yes, in the findings he did specify that he pled guilty, and I believe in the findings he said that he found that he was insincere. And I think, and I know from his oral ruling, pardon me, my mouth is dry. I know from his oral ruling in the court that he said to us, you couldn't afford to have this in front of a jury, that's why you pled guilty. Well, Hoadley could afford to have it in front of a jury, and he killed the person. You never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen in front of a jury. But if you actually do step up to the plate, whether a person thinks it's tactical or not, saying, I'm guilty, has got to be worth something. It especially should be worth something when the person who killed the man and said, I'm not guilty, gets convicted and gets life.
Are you suggesting there's a per se rule that if you do plead guilty, you can avoid the death penalty?
Absolutely not. And you could never have it that way, because then the death penalty would have no effect whatsoever. No effect whatsoever. Because then any time a person who is facing the death penalty could just say, hey, I plead guilty, I'm going to get away with it. But what I am saying is, when you have a situation where you have a 19-year-old young man who has no prior violent felonies, who's exhibited goodness in the past, who was involved in a situation like this, and who does plead guilty, and who's so very different from the other people in South Dakota who have been sentenced to death, that should at least weigh in his favor. It especially should weigh in his favor when the putative killer, the undisputed killer, gets life. Mind you, when we're dealing with these young men, and not that a 19-year-old or a 20-year-old isn't capable of making an evil choice and doing something terrible, but really, if you think about the 19-year-olds, you know, their personalities aren't fully formed. You haven't grown up yet. We see many 19-year-olds that make stupid mistakes. Now, they all don't go out and kill somebody, but the point being, a 19-year-old who pleads guilty, first felony charge, is different from someone who's 40 or 35, who's had many, many scrapes with the law, who's had many, many chances at reform, and who's thumbed his nose at the system, exercised his right to a trial when he knows he's done something wrong, and then faces the ultimate punishment. So no, I'm not suggesting there should be a per se rule at all, but what I am suggesting is that it's got to be, we have to give him some credit for it. Now that doesn't necessarily need to save the day, but it does put him in a much different situation than Hoadley, and that's what flows into the gross disproportionality between this co-defendant proportionality as required by our statutes and the case law. So
it sounds to me like you should have gone before a jury and made that argument rather than to have it fall on deaf ears with the court.
Yeah. I argued a case here a month ago, tried a case, and I remember saying hindsight's 20/20, and I must tell you, sincerely, I wish I would have done that. I wish I would have done that. I didn't do that, and here I am. I other than that, I don't know what to say. I wish I would have put it before a jury. But there's also a good side to pleading guilty. The good side, saving the family, the trouble of a long, drawn-out trial. Isn't that the first step in redemption? How do we ever change unless we admit that what we've done is wrong? How do we ever change if we sit there and make excuses for everything for a long time, especially when we're 19?
But you could have gone before a jury. You could have gone before a jury and admit the charge and go before the jury for mitigation or for sentencing.
Well, you could have gone before the jury and admitted the charge before the jury and have them find you guilty and then go on to sentencing. But you couldn't have pled guilty and then gone on to sentencing
right.
Before a jury.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, you could have done that. One could have done that.
I thought Judge Johnson offered you the opportunity to have a sentencing jury.
He did offer us. Several times he offered us the opportunity to have a sentencing jury. However, the only time that he had the authority to offer us a sentencing jury was while there was no guilty plea on the table. Judge Johnson did not have the authority to allow a sentencing jury once the guilty plea has been entered. The guilty plea, the entry of it under the statute, the general statute for guilty pleas and under the death penalty section of the code requires a court trial. So whether he offered it or not, he had no right to offer it. There would have been error had it occurred. There's no statutory authority for it. And from that standpoint, yes, he did offer it, but he didn't have the right to. That's when we get into the second issue, which is Ring. I can continue on with this issue if I have additional. I would like to close up this disproportionality or the co-defendant disproportionality issue with this. We're dealing with a death penalty case. Heightened scrutiny applies. We have to look at these facts in great detail. And really, when you look at these facts, when you look at what these three young men did, there is no parsing up. And if you do parse up, if you really want to parse up and be fair about it, about who did what, I think we can agree upon the basic proposition that the killer, the one who snuffed out the life, is at least as culpable as those around him. This is not a situation where you have a reluctant aider and abettor standing on the fringes, going in and doing something at the last second to alleviate the suffering. Daryl Hoadley bent down next to Mr. Pohl, lit a lighter to illuminate his face so Elijah Page could kick him. That's not the work of a reluctant aider and abettor. Ring, I want to talk about Ring for just a moment. The development in Ring has been something else in death penalty litigation. And as we all know, the import of Ring was that it applied Apprendi to death penalty situations and aggravating factors, aggravating circumstances, and determined that they were actually functional equivalents to elements of the offenses and in the federal system required that they be charged by indictment That's not applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment, as Ring makes clear. However, we know that in order for a court to hand down a sentence, they have to have the ability to hand that sentence down. And I ask you this. If a person pleads guilty to just a straight murder charge, straight pleading, that doesn't deal in any way with aggravating circumstances, do extra steps need to be taken in order for that person to be eligible for the death penalty? And the answer to that question is yes. Aggravating circumstances have to be proven. Now, in this case, you know, we had our sentencing, we had our aggravating circumstances, they presented evidence about it. But what Ring does is it requires that those aggravating circumstances somehow be charged. The state is going to say, wait a second, the defense had adequate notice of all this, they actually received the aggravating circumstances in writing, and from that standpoint, it satisfies the requirements of Ring. It doesn't. Our state statutes require that a charge be set forth in either an indictment or an information. In this case, the murder charge was set forth by way of an indictment. The aggravators were set forth by way of a separate pleading that did not meet the requirements for an information. So once the judge receives the plea on the bare charge, what's the sentence that's available immediately? The sentence that is available immediately is life without parole. What changes that? What changes that are the aggravating circumstances and the trial on the aggravating circumstances. And it's our position, since those aggravators were not set forth by way of an information, that the court did not have the jurisdiction to impose the death penalty.
How was the writing designated that set forth the aggravating factors?
It was just like a motion would be, a caption, notice of aggravating circumstances. The state notices that they're going to go on the following aggravating circumstances, and it's signed by a prosecutor.
And was that received prior to the plea of guilty?
It was. It was.
Like 3 months before?
Substantially before.
So you're not claiming you were bushwhacked or anything?
Not a bit. We had no idea that Ring was going to come down this way. Did not raise the issues in the underlying matter. Subject matter jurisdiction, however, cannot be waived, cannot be given up, cannot be stopped. And it would be our position that since Ring now says aggravating circumstances act as elements, the elements have to somehow be charged. Under our state statutes, you charge by an indictment or an information. Since that didn't occur, death is not available as a sentence, is our position here, in light of Ring.
So the effect of that is that if your client would have been originally charged with the elements in the indictment or the information and gone through a preliminary hearing with an information, it would change the whole scope of the plea, would it not?
Sure, yes.
Because if you would plead, then you'd have to plead guilty to the whole thing, including the aggravating circumstances.
Exactly, because they would be elements of the offense. Whereas here, you plead to the elements of the offense, the bare elements of the offense, without reference to the aggravators. Without reference to the aggravators, what's the only sentence that's available under the law? Life. Okay. Under Ring and Apprendi.
How do you account for the fact that virtually no state court has ruled your way on this issue, with the exception of perhaps New Jersey or one of those that has a different constitutional language, or at least they rely on different constitutional language, and they do not involve the indictment clause under the federal constitution?
I account for that as follows. The state, in its response to this issue, indicates that charges must be specified by way of an indictment or an information. In this case, the elements of the murder, which would allow for the imposition of the death penalty, were not so specified. So we've got a state constitution, we've got statutes which require informations, we've got this federal decision of Ring indicating that in order for a person to be subject to the aggravators, they have to somehow be charged out either by indictment or information, and I think it says that in Ring, either by indictment or information. And in this case, you don't have the information. Granted, it's coming up after the fact, but you still have this federal constitutional principle that's applicable to the states and that in this case would support the imposition of a life sentence at this point. Not only for that reason, but for the proportionality reasons as well, we'd be asking for a life sentence in this case, because when the killer receives life and one of the others who Mr. Fitzgerald referred to as aiding and abetting at least some or all of these acts in his arguments received death.
Well, I still didn't hear how you would distinguish all the other state cases which have held otherwise.
I can't distinguish all of the other state cases. I can't distinguish them. They have different statutes. What I can do, though, is say that Ring requires that the aggravators be charged either in an indictment or, as the state has indicated, in information, and I think Ring specifies that. And in this case, we don't have those. We don't have those. Ring has also been applied retroactively to habeas, all federal habeas cases. And while this matter wasn't available to us at the time of the plea, the matter was essentially dealt with in the co-defendant's case and in the underlying matter, and is clearly within the purview of this court because the appeal is pending.
Now, you've made some fleeting references to life imprisonment. If you prevail on any of your claims of error, are you seeking any relief other than a life imprisonment?
Well, I must tell you, my first preference would be life imprisonment, because then this is ended for everybody. But if the court does not deem it necessary to impose life imprisonment, then it would be our request that this be remanded back for further sentencing. Mind you, though, the statutes that we have in effect, if this is remanded back for further sentencing, still do not allow for a jury trial on this issue. Still do not allow for a jury trial on this issue. And we're in exactly the same situation that Arizona was in Ring, having a judge determine the functional equivalent of elements to a crime that have been uncharged by way of any formal document other than this bare notice that does not comply with the statutes.
Could we have to make a finding that the statute is unconstitutional then as to the lack of jury trial benefit?
Well, I think that, first of all, in order to turn this into a life sentence, no, you don't have to make that finding, because simply put, when the killer receives life and the other people who even the prosecution has referred to at some point as an aider and abettor receive death, their sentences should be reduced to life anyway. But if you have to do it based upon the decision in Ring, yes, I think that we're going to have to deal with the constitutionality of that statute, and we're also going to have to deal with the mechanics of the way these cases are charged, much the same way that all the other states across the country are having to do it at this point in time.
So why wouldn't it go back for a new trial?
What's that?
Why wouldn't it go back for a new trial, if that's right?
Why wouldn't it go back for a new trial? Because he's pled guilty, and there's been no motion to withdraw the guilty plea. If he's pled guilty and that stands, we're not asking that that be reversed. And if it's remanded back under the present statutes, there is no ability for a jury trial on the sentencing. The statutes don't allow it. They explicitly disallow it. Disallow it.
But shouldn't the state have the right to charge before a jury the aggravating factors that you say they missed?
I don't know the answer to that question. I guess under the procedural makeup of our laws at this point in time, and I'm not trying to be glib about this either, the state's right to recharge the aggravating circumstance is not something that exists in statute right now. So from that standpoint, I would say no. He's pled guilty to it. He's pled guilty to it. If it's remanded back, it doesn't extinguish his guilty plea. Doesn't extinguish his guilty plea. Unless somehow the legislature in the meantime changed its procedural rules surrounding the death penalty and made allowance for such, and even then I would suspect there would be some issues.
What about waiver now? We all know that you can waive constitutional rights. It's done every day in every courtroom in this country.
Yes, it is.
And why hasn't your client waived this right by his plea?
Well, before the plea, before he pled guilty, he was advised that he had a right to a jury trial and that the entry of a plea would waive that right. Okay, and he waived his right to a jury trial. But after he entered his plea, he had no right to a jury sentencer. And if he had no right to a jury sentencer after he waived his plea, then he could not waive it. He could not waive it.
But he expressly waived it several times. Judge Johnson, whether he had authority or not, offered him the opportunity for a jury trial.
I agree.
Anyway, he waived. How many times was it?
I think I think that it was addressed either probably two times. I would think.
Then you're telling us the statute's unconstitutional, but it's still binding. If it's unconstitutional, why can't Johnson bring in the jury and say we're going to have a trial?
I don't know the answer to that. Why can't he bring in a jury and say we're going to have a trial? Because The general statute on guilty pleas says once you plead guilty, the court shall proceed with sentencing.
Well, that may be unconstitutional in this case too, based on your argument on Rain.
Well, like I said, I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, this judge has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution.
I agree.
You have 2 minutes.
All right. Let me touch on the final issue, Toby Givens. When you look at the court's findings surrounding what we would say equal prosecutorial misconduct, you will see that never was it mentioned that the prosecuting attorney in this case admitted under oath that what he did for Toby Givens was a favor. Never ever was it addressed at all, the fact that the court had interposed an order, which I believe is defendant's motion for disclosure of consideration for witnesses, that was binding upon the state and that wasn't appealed, that required the state to notify us of anything of service or any consideration whatsoever relating to or in close proximity with any interviews or such testimony, and then it sets forth what consideration is. Here in this case, I can't bring you a quote from the record like on Perry Mason, where I get the prosecutor to admit, yes, we had a deal beforehand, or where I get anybody to admit, yes, we had a deal beforehand. But when you look at the circumstances of this case, the request that Mr. Givens had made for early release, the fact that he was advised by the court that he was not going to be released without the favorable recommendation of his captors, the fact that he spoke with Mr. Fitzgerald 3 times within 3 weeks of his testimony and asked, he talked about how he wanted to get out, and the fact that 4 days after the death penalty was imposed, Mr. Fitzgerald is acting as his personal delivery man and running this letter over to the court and making requests and making recommendations. It's our position here that circumstantially, what you see with Toby Givens is not allowed, and that would have made a difference in a case like this. The findings of the court as it related to the Givens matter don't take into account those key facts. I would ask that this court...
Let me ask you one thing about
this. Yes.
If we adopt what you ask us to do in that case...
I didn't hear you.
If we adopt what you've asked us to do on the Givens issue, aren't we then saying to... criminal law practitioners in this state that from this day forward they must disclose the subjective expectations of a defendant or of a witness as to what they think the plea bargain might be?
You don't have
to. How could the prosecution ever divine the subjective expectation of a witness?
You don't have to tell practitioners that. What you can tell practitioners is that when a defendant makes a motion asking for that type of information, and when the state doesn't object to it, the state is bound by it, whether they like it or not, especially in a death penalty case. You can make a rule that that this stuff need not ordinarily be supplied, but here we have a specific motion that was not objected to, an order was entered, an order was noticed, and it's binding upon the state under State versus Solly. And they did not comply with it. So that doesn't need to be the law from this point forward, although you can't just hide these hopes and these kind of hidden agreements with a wink and a nod about, hey, we'll talk about that later. I'll leave you with this. If you think about the testimony of the paralegal Thomas Balloon, who actually worked for Hoadley, he said that Toby Givens told him, Fitzgerald told me he couldn't promise me anything, he could give me no concrete deal, but I knew he would get me out. Now, when you look at that and you combine it with Givens' admissions, you will see circumstantial proof of a quid pro quo. There would be no other reason in the world for Mr. Fitzgerald to run and do that but for payment for services rendered. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you. You got an extra 2 minutes. But that's
oh, fine. I did? Well, good. Thank you.
Okay. You're a hard man to interrupt. Okay. Mr. Eichstead, you have 35 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I thought that while it's fresh in mind, I would just address the Toby Givens issue, and the important thing about that, I think, is, as with much of this case, is to look at the findings, the specific findings that Judge Johnson made in that regard. And in the state's view, in the way the state reads the record, and I think the way that Judge Johnson heard the witnesses, there wasn't anything to disclose. I think that Perhaps Mr. Wrench is saying that any subjective hope that Givens had to get out of jail would need to be disclosed. Well, that subjective hope was a matter of public record already prior to the time that that the sentencing hearing went forward, and there just was was nothing else that they didn't know about that could have conceivably been used either for cross-examination or for any other purpose.
Just a minute, though. You're saying that his subjective hope was a matter of public record? I didn't see that.
He had, in the cases where he had been convicted of simple assault, and of course he was convicted of simple assault, had a one-year sentence. In those cases, he had already written to the judge, asked that his sentence be reduced, and those letters were on file in those cases. So his subjective hope to get out was a matter of public record, as was, I believe, his desire to go to college, which is another thing that was set out in the request that was delivered by Mr. Fitzgerald.
And you don't think that the fact that the state's attorney, Mr. Fitzgerald, came over to see him and then delivered his papers to the judge and didn't object to it had anything else to do with it?
The fact that it was granted?
The fact that he was let out. He had a year to go and he was let out the next day.
He had about 6 or 7 months to go, Your Honor. He served 4 or 5. I suspect that Judge Johns, who was the sentencing judge there, considered that. But then he was considering a number of other things as well, and the record indicates fairly clearly that without a recommendation from your captors was really an indication that his behavior at the jail had to improve before Judge Johns would in fact let him go. And Judge Johns testified here, whether that was appropriate or not under this court's cases, I really don't know. But he did say that while he considered the state's recommendation, he also was more concerned with the fact that Mr. Givens' behavior at the jail had improved, and he also said that when he gives someone a maximum sentence for a misdemeanor of a year, he will ordinarily reduce that sentence simply because if someone gets a felony sentence, they'll likely be paroled ahead of time, and he doesn't see that the maximum sentence is really appropriate in most cases.
You've been an assistant attorney general for what?
20 years, Your Honor.
20 years? Have you ever heard of a case before where the state's attorney went over to the defendant in the jail who's serving a year sentence or 6 to 7 months for this type of a procedure under these circumstances?
I haven't previously, but then I don't operate in trial courts, Your Honor, and Judge Johns did testify that he thought maybe something similar had happened in one instance that he could remember. And
where
he'd been on the trial bench for a number of years.
Where the state's attorney Fitzgerald had done this?
I don't know if it was specifically Fitzgerald. I think it may have been, right? But I understand it's fairly unusual, in fact, quite unusual. But what we have against that here are the specific findings of Judge Johnson, and also the fact that there really is nothing except a subjective hope. Givens himself testified, and Judge Johnson said that he believed the testimony, that he was not going to get out unless Judge Johnson changed his mind, unless he improved his behavior. And he testified further that he had no deal, and Judge Johnson believed that testimony over and above the testimony of Mr. Balloon that Mr. Wrench referred to. So that unless it's so clear that it's clearly erroneous, and that Judge Johnson had no right to believe that testimony, this court would need to affirm on that basis. It would be our our view. With regard to the supposed gross disproportionality issue, I would like to review some of the facts first that perhaps place a little different light on it than the defendant would like to place on it. As the defendant has indicated, as of March 12th, the evening of March 12th, the defendant and his cohorts were involved. They were over at the house of Dottie Pogue and her two children, one of whom was Chester Allen Pogue. Now, Dottie and her daughter were away in Florida on vacation, so it was just Chester Allen Pogue and these three defendants. And while they were there, the defendant, Riley Piper, called out Page and indicated that he was going to, quote, jack, unquote, Allen, which means either to kill him or perhaps not to kill him, but at least to steal all of his stuff or his property. And so that was where the matter started, was with this defendant. And Judge Johnson found that he was the one that was the instigator and the leader in the crime. Nobody throughout this, and including the two defendants themselves and their statements, has ever characterized Hoadley as a leader. He rather was a follower. And by the way, we also disagree strongly with characterizing him as the actual killer, because while he may have done the blow that did the that actually snuffed the life out of the last life out in the end, in fact, Chester Allen Pogue was going to die anyway from all of the other blows that had been inflicted, most of them not by Hoadley, and so he's really not in the same position as a trigger man. And I guess the case that comes to mind is the David Woff case, where Mr. Woff actually went out and did all of the shooting. There was more violence, by all accounts, committed by the other two defendants. It's certainly by Mr. Page, but Mr. Piper was the instigator, and the Judge Johnson further found that he had the ability to coax and encourage others to commit crimes for him, including an example of where he had encouraged Hoadley to attempt to hit someone over the head out on the West Coast to rob him. Also, where he got Page to stab a fellow by the name of Scott Hunter, who they believe may have been telling the police on them, and also where he encouraged both Page and another young person to go out and get into the house of a friend by the name of Russell Olson, whom they knew had gone off to Europe for a few days or for a week. And further, we see that Piper's immediate past, and by that I'm talking about the last 3 or 4 years, is it contains almost uniformly bad behavior. The goodness in the past and so on that we're talking about here is pretty much entirely pre-adolescent, before he was 13 or 14. For the last 5 years, it's been uniformly drugs and crime and fast living and going about. So I really don't think that in itself is a mitigating factor on his behalf. In addition, he had a good family background. He had a good set of parents. They came and testified, and they were there, and they talked about how they had a family, and there were no problems. We aren't talking about someone who has had a poor background, as I think it would be admitted have both Page and Hoadley.
So is that a mitigating circumstance, or?
It's a bad background, I think more often than not, is considered mitigating, but certainly someone who has grown up in a normal family and has had an excellent upbringing, that doesn't explain why he would turn to crime and do all these things when he was 13 or 14. There may be some explanation of that, although certainly the state doesn't concede that it's necessarily mitigating, but what I'm saying is that it's not present here at all in terms of bad background. Maybe he did this because of bad background.
Was there any positive mitigating findings by the judge?
The judge realized that he pled guilty, but no, he didn't find that to be mitigating. He figured it was tactical and possible avoiding the death penalty. So I don't really believe that Judge Johnson found anything on the positive side for
him. Well, he said he'd been a good scout at one time or something.
Well, yeah, that's in there. And as I said, that's all pre-adolescence, before he's like 13 or 14. And so it's 5 or 6 years ago. So, it, you know, and maybe that's mitigating to some extent, but really, it just shows that there's no bad background there.
Does he discuss at all the age, the fact that he's only 19?
I think he discusses it. He doesn't necessarily find it mitigating. It isn't something that he spent a lot of time on, Your Honor. In addition to these other factors, it's plain from the evidence that the first actual violence done on Chester Allen Pogue was this kick when they were still at the house, because once they had left the Pogue's house, they went over to the house where Paige, Piper, and Hoadley apparently also were staying, and they had lured Allen over to this house. And once they were over there, Paige took a gun, which he had stolen from the Dottie Polk's bedroom, and forced Allen down to the floor, at which time Paige kicked him. There was really no evidence that Hoadley was involved in actual violence at the time of at the home. He did apparently go get some wire and help tie up the victim.
Who actually stole the gun? I frankly have been a little bit confused reading the record as to who actually stole the gun that was used.
Yeah, that may be, there may be some controversy to that. On balance, it seems to the state that it was probably Paige, but it could have been Piper, but it wasn't Hoadley, and that's the point. I think that Hoadley was not the one that stole the gun at the time.
What bothers me a little bit is going back maybe to rehabilitation. Is you have a 19-year-old boy or young man, and even at a minimum, he's facing life in prison, and there's no real effort or no real thought given to whether or not he can be rehabilitated. And of course, there would be some hope, of course, if he got a life sentence, and then if he were rehabilitated and really became a good person, obviously a governor someday could commute that to a definite term, which would then make him eligible for parole somewhere along the line. But tell me about that there's, you know, why is there no look, no effort whatsoever at whether or not he can possibly be rehabilitated?
I think it has to do with a couple of things. That would be, the first would be his background and the fact that he's been involved in crimes and he's established this pattern. And even though he's only 19, we're talking about an ongoing pattern for the course of about 6 years. The other is the terrible nature of this crime and the fact that there was so much violence used against this, whom even the defendant describes as a friend or a completely innocent person, and I think that it's those two things in combination. The fact that he's been the way he's been for probably a good 6 years, and the fact that he has planned and committed this horrible crime and directed the other two in committing it, not only directed them in committing that, but directed them in committing other crimes. I think the pattern has been established,
So in for the purpose of either revenge or retribution, we give up on rehabilitation because he's 19 years old and he's had his chance?
Well, that's certainly one spin you could put on it, Your Honor. But I think that it's this type of a crime, and when one is sentenced to life imprisonment, of course, it's a matter of. Not really considering rehabilitation, but rather the fact that now he's got one of the ultimate penalties, and that's going to go for the rest of his life. So yes, I think once he's committed this sort of a crime, and once he has the background that he has, rehabilitation is not really a factor anymore.
I have another question on the comparison of the defendants in this case. It appeared to me that Judge Johnson did not necessarily differentiate on the backgrounds of the three in a great detail. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seemed that it comes down to the differences between the defendants is who did the most blows and the parceling out of the actions of the crime itself, as opposed to the backgrounds or the mitigating elements of each of the defendants?
He talked about the mitigation and pretty much discounted it. That much I'd agree with, Your Honor. But there's more to it than just the crime itself. There's what occurred after the crime and when they were in jail. There's expression by Hoadley of remorse at the time he's in jail, or at least that's what's reported by Toby Givens. And the additional thing that's reported by Toby Givens and by Tom Curtis and by the other inmate who testified is that Piper was planning escape and he was planning the further murder of guards, which is another factor that doesn't apply to the other two defendants. And that's another reason for finding Piper to be more culpable and more dangerous, I would say, because now we've got him planning and attempting to engineer an escape, and we also have him expressing pleasure at the killing, expressing how he was proud of it, and also relishing the killing, and that is something that we once again don't have with regard to the other two defendants. Hoadley has never, for example, as has Piper, expressed to the mother of a friend his desire to kill someone just to see what it feels like. He's also never expressed that we can see to his friends, which Piper has done. So it's all of these things that enter into it, I think, and all of those things are contained in Judge Johnson's findings. And as has been pointed out here, I think, by Justice Zinner, Judge Johnson really is the one judge or the one jurist who has knowledge of all three of these cases. He sat through both penalty hearings, he sat through the trial, and he also conducted two remand hearings pursuant to this court's express direction. And so it would seem to the state that his findings ought to be given credence simply because he's the one that knows, he's had the opportunity to see and to hear these witnesses, and he found all of these things that I mentioned as reasons why Briley Piper is more culpable than is Daryl Hoadley.
If we disagree with Judge Johnson's conclusion on that, on equal culpability, if we should decide that these three are equally culpable, would we then be bound to order a life sentence for the two that received death?
I don't really think so, Your Honor, because the findings of fact are just the findings of fact, and in fact there is discretion sentencing, so that Judge Johnson, when he made the decision, he had the right to either grant or not grant mercy
if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the sentencer can have co-defendants equally guilty standing before them, and the sentencer can say, life for you, death for you.
Well,
I choose to give mercy on one, but I choose to not. In my discretion, I give no mercy.
If you're positing absolute equality, then they'd have to get the same sentence, Your Honor. No question about that, because there is the proportionality review, but in human affairs, any two things are hardly absolutely equal or never equal and completely. And in order to do your proportionality review, there's still considerable discretion in the sentencer. But the court takes a look at the proportionality review and determines from that whether these are grossly disproportionate. That would be the proportionality review under Bonner and so on, or under the more extended proportionality review that exists in a death penalty case, that the court compares the facts of the cases.
How do we do that? Now I'm curious. Under our statute, under our state statute, it's mandatory. We have the obligation to do our own proportionality analysis, don't we?
Yes.
And what standard do we use? Is that a de novo standard, or are we bound by the trial court's findings unless they're clearly erroneous?
State would argue that it's a type of abuse of discretion standard, because this court has indicated that the sentencer has discretion. And if we're talking about a jury, they may determine under the Rhines case to go ahead and give mercy to one defendant and not another. But then this court needs to take a look at the two cases.
I mean, we have the obligation by statute to do this ourselves.
Oh, that's true.
This isn't something the trial court does, is it? The statute puts the obligation to decide proportionality on us.
Proportionality, yes, but not de novo sentencing, and that's the distinction, I believe. The court has indicated that there is still discretion that resides in the sentencer. You determine when you do proportionality review whether that discretion has been abused, and the way that you determine that is you look at the facts of the cases, and if, as you posited, the cases or the participation were absolutely identical, and the backgrounds of the defendants were absolutely identical, and their attitudes toward the crimes were absolutely identical, and they acted the same in jail once they were arrested, and those facts were absolutely identical, then of course the court is going to reverse it. Now, the more difficult case that the court would have to consider would be
identical, isn't it? That isn't.
No, that isn't it. If they were, but I was answering that. That's not the absolute standard. What I was about to say is that the more difficult situation is where they might be close. And then the court just needs to make a discretionary determination. This court has some discretion, obviously, and has the last word in making that comparison. But the sentencer also has discretion. And the fact that one person is sentenced to life imprisonment is really more a function, in a lot of cases anyway, of the fact that mercy was granted to that person. And Rhines and Moeller both indicate the cases that this court decided that just because mercy was granted in one case doesn't mean that it needs to be granted in another.
What is it about the statute, to follow up on Justice Connacht's question, what is it about the statute that imposes the independent obligation on us to review this that suggests that we do not have equal discretion with that of the trial court?
The statute itself, Your Honor,
or cases, or
yeah, that it's the state's view that the Rhines case indicates that there's sentencing discretion in the jury or in the trial court. I mean, there's not a de novo review in this court, and as long as the trial court has some sentencing discretion, then this court will consider that discretion along with the other factors that are or aren't present. But of course, the court needs to consider each of the cases. But there's also, in the case law, a heavy dose of discretion that the court will consider. And as to proportionality, of course, it's the state's argument, as I indicated, that there are these factors that differentiate these two individuals. And it's not a matter of just co-defendants, and therefore there's automatically life if one gets life. And of course, that isn't what the defendant is arguing. I think that where the two parties differ in this case is the facts and the interpretation that they place on the facts. And there's no more significant piece of evidence, I don't think, as to the differing nature of these defendants than the testimony of what they did after they were arrested, and also the testimony of how they participated in the crime, and also the testimony of what their backgrounds were. They differ in all those instances, and this court ought to consider those facts when it is considering how to resolve the case. I've already discussed the plea bargain with Toby Gibbons. I would like to move on to the third issue, or at least it might be the second one in terms of the order it was discussed, which is the matter of the cases of Ring, Apprendi, and Jones. we need to take a look at what the Ring case actually holds. The Ring case actually holds that the that there must be an opportunity for a defendant to have the existence of aggravating factors determined by a jury. That's the only holding of that case. It doesn't hold that the aggravating factors need to be alleged in an indictment or an information. Rather, it holds that they need to be decided, or that there at least needs to be the opportunity to have them decided by a jury. That opportunity existed here because Judge Johnson specifically offered each of the three defendants the opportunity, and Page and Piper specifically, even though they were going to plead guilty, he offered them the opportunity to go in front of a jury for determination of the aggravating circumstances, and for that matter, for determination of the ultimate sentence, something that Ring doesn't require, but that state law requires.
Was the state in agreement with that, with the judge's offer, or did they object to that?
Absolutely. In fact, the state was ready to go forward and try it as a matter of before a jury. Now, I think what the defendant may be arguing here is that state law would require these aggravating factors to be alleged in an indictment or information. I don't see that anywhere in the state statutes. And furthermore, as Justice Zinner pointed out, there are many, many cases, the single exception being New Jersey, and the main reason for that being that they have the same clause in their constitution as does the federal government, requiring that things be handled by indictment. All of these other case law and these other cases, and they're cited in our brief and our supplemental brief, indicate that it's not necessary to allege these factors in indictment or information. That's one part.
When the state was prepared, as you say, to go forward with the sentencing by a jury,
yes,
in accordance with what the judge offered, was there any objection on the part of the defendant that the trial court had no authority to do that?
No, it didn't, and I doubt that he would have made that objection, because he was the one that was insisting that it go solely in front of the judge, which is another grounds for rejecting this issue, which is waiver, because the judge was saying, okay, we'll impanel a jury and we'll decide this matter, and defense counsel said, no, we want you to decide it yourself, Your Honor. We don't want to go in front of a jury. So that in itself is not only a waiver, but it comes pretty close to being invited error. This is what I want done. Concept of invited error being defendant saying, this is what I want done, and the court proceeding exactly as the defendant had requested.
But do you concede that there is a flaw in our statute that once a person pleads guilty to murder, there is no statutory right to have a trial on the aggravating circumstance?
No, I don't concede that at all, Your Honor. The statute that the defendant is citing says that in non-jury cases, the judge shall, after conducting the pre-sentencing hearing and so on. Now, I'd interpret that to mean non-jury insofar as the penalty phase itself is concerned. It doesn't say that it's non-jury guilt phase only. I'd say that means non-jury all the way. And furthermore, there are other statutes that state that the judge is supposed to instruct the jury, and even if the statute itself doesn't say this shall go in front of the jury after there's been a guilty plea, there are other statutes that we've cited on page 98 of our brief that say that if there's no specifically prescribed procedure, then the court may proceed in any lawful manner. And I think that's where we come to perhaps the question that Justice Gilbertson asked. In the state's view, and we state that as well on page 98 of our brief, the fact that no jury can be had for those who plead guilty and to determine the sentence and so on, where it is granted if you plead not guilty, That procedure has been held unconstitutional quite a long time ago. If you look at the case, it's in our brief. It's a U.S. Supreme Court held that way in 1968. Some other state courts have since said that. So it would, there needs to be the opportunity for the jury and for one who pleads guilty. We concede that. But we also contend that our statutes do not prohibit it. And that's really what the defendant is contending, is that the statutes flatly prohibit it and deprive the trial court of jurisdiction to go forward and have a jury. And that's not the case, because the catch-all statute that we've cited allows the court to proceed in any lawful manner not inconsistent with the title. And the statutes don't flatly prohibit it. They just, they could be clearer, I suppose, but since they don't prohibit it, the court's not deprived of jurisdiction to impanel a jury, and the court could well have gone forward under these statutes and allowed for it. So that, I believe, is really the nub of the issue that the defendant is bringing up. He says that the trial court had no jurisdiction because, A, the aggravating factors are not alleged in the indictment, and B, the statutes don't specifically provide for it. Well, that's not a jurisdictional issue. And even a defective indictment is not a jurisdictional issue. It's a matter of whether or not the defendant is prejudiced by it, as this court has already held in the State versus David Lynn Anderson case that we cite in the brief. Even if the indictment's defective, which we don't concede, and which almost all state trial courts have also held in the favor of the state. Even if it is defective, there still needs to be prejudice, and there's no prejudice here because the aggravating factors were duly alleged in another pleading that was served on the defendant plenty of time, so that he knew what they were and he'd be able to meet them.
Well, if the we were going to be required to interpret the statutes in this case to see if the right to jury trial is afforded. We're going to have to decide that in this case.
Well, if we
decide that there is no such right, is that the kind of structural error that would require that this sentence be set aside?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because it's the defendant's own personal right to a jury trial. It's not a matter of structural error. He can still waive that right to a jury trial. He can request that he be granted a trial to the court, and he got exactly what he asked for in this instance.
You have about a minute and a half.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. The state argues, as I've stated here, and as we've stated in our brief, that there are differences, that there are many differences between Briley Piper's background, his participation, and the way that he acted afterwards. Many differences from the way that Darrell Holdley acted, what his participation was, and so on. And because there are those differences, and because those differences were specifically found by Judge Johnson, the sentence is not grossly disproportionate, and it ought to be affirmed. Likewise, there's no evidence that Toby Givens was given, if you will, any consideration ahead of time. And that's really what's important there, is that there be some consideration prior to the plea hearing taking place. And furthermore, there is no merit to the contention that defendant could not have received a jury trial here had he wanted it. For those reasons and for the other reasons set forth in our brief, we'd request that the death sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Eckstead. Mr. Duffy, you have 15 minutes, sir. If you want to bring a water glass up to the podium, go ahead. I should have told Mr. Wrench that earlier. You're speaking for an extended period of time.
I have been waiting all my life to stand here in front of you and talk to you about a case like this. I don't wish that I had tried it to a jury, and I don't mean this to be disrespectful or combative. I honestly don't wish I tried this to a jury. I would much rather talk to five jurists about this case now than any jury I could impanel in the world. particularly when it comes to the proportionality issue. Some of the things said about proportionality in this case, particularly some of the findings of the trial court, are nothing short of outrageous. The two incidents discussed by Mr. Eichstadt in support of the distinction that should be made between my client, Briley Pfeiffer, and Mr. Hoadley, are what I'll call the LSD frying pan incident and the Scott Hunter incident. You would laugh those findings out of court in any civil case. In any other criminal case, you would too. And in a death penalty case, to say they're a hoax is not too strong. Here's what the frying pan case is all about, for the benefit of the audience, although I know the court knows what it was all about. The trial court found that Briley Pfeiffer ought to die, be strapped to a gurney and die, because he had told Darrell Hoadley out in Oregon, "Darrell, you kill somebody." Well, that's awful dramatic, isn't it? Till you look at the facts. And what were the facts? That Darrell Hoadley, Briley Pfeiffer, my client, and another person, unnamed, were all high on LSD out in Oregon. Seems like there's a little bit of a problem there. High on LSD, Hoadley says he remembered Pfeiffer telling him to hit a guy in the head with a frying pan and rob him. Did it happen? How do we know? They were all high on LSD. Did he hit him in the head with a frying pan? No. Did he rob him? No. Didn't rob him either. Was it ever reported to the police? No. Did Hoadley ever testify to that? No. How did we find out this wonderful, incredible story that is supposed to distinguish my client from Mr. Hoadley? Mr. Hoadley told his mitigation expert that, who related at the trial during the sentencing phase. Was there ever any cross-examination of Hoadley? No. From that tangled web, I don't know how many people in this building have taken LSD. I wouldn't want to count on anybody's memories that came out of that. But I sure wouldn't count on it, and if I were the state, I wouldn't count on it. I wouldn't stand up here and say, not only do I want to count on it, not only would I accredit, they have never accredited a story like that in the history of the South Dakota AG's office. But not only do they want to accredit it, they want to accredit it and use it to distinguish one 19-year-old from another so that the state can kill him. As if that wasn't enough, we move on to the Scott Hunter story. This has got to be the most outrageous credibility finding in the history of my experience trying cases. I'm nearly half a century old. I don't know, I've tried 50 jury trials, not as many as I hope to when I'm all said and done. I have never heard anything like this in my life. What's the story? The story is that Scott Hunter supposedly was ordered to be stabbed or killed or beaten by Page on orders of Pfeiffer. Did it happen? No. Never happened. Did Page ever do this? No, he never did it. Did Hunter ever report an attack? No, he never reported an attack. Did Hunter testify? Yes, he did. How did he testify? He testified by telephone. And what did he tell the trial court? Never happened. Never happened. What did the trial court do in this case? He turned around and said it did. It's the only time in my life, and the only time I think in the lives of all of us, we will ever see a victim deny an attack took place and have a trial court judge say, yes, it did, and I'm going to use it to kill a 19-year-old boy. And when I say use it to kill, is that harsh? Not too harsh. These findings found nothing. They did no balancing at all between Hoadley and Pfeiffer. And they gilded the Hoadley lily dramatically. Hoadley was a little beast. Hoadley was a twisted little beast. It was Hoadley who knew where to take him to kill him. It was Hoadley who got out on the floor and soaked up the blood after he'd been kicked. It was Hoadley who helped tie him up. It was Hoadley out at the scene who stabbed him in the neck and said that he tossed the rock on his head because he got tired of listening to him scream. It was Hoadley when he picked up the rocks, and these weren't little rocks, 144 pounds and 19 pounds. It was Hoadley who said that when I crushed his skull, I could hear it crack. And when I did that, I could hear the air whooshing out of his air hole, which was, of course, what? The air hole he had stabbed into Pogue's neck. Not only did he do all of these things, but my client wasn't even present when it happened. He was sitting up in the vehicle that they'd brought him there with. Wow. And Hoadley's little gemstone? Gets worse. Doesn't get better. Gets worse. It's Hoadley who tells Page to throw the pistol out of the window. At the end of this business, Hoadley, who ends up with all the stuff, he's a little ghoul. Why do I say he's a little ghoul? He's not just an avaricious little thief. He was that. He ended up with a Sony PlayStation. He ended up with a coin collection. He ended up with all kinds of scattered bits of stuff that I know you're familiar with. But the really ghoulish stuff make the hair rise up on the back of your neck. And what is it? When they got there to where he lived, this is weeks later, much of the loot had been pawned. There was no reason to keep a lot of this stuff. What did law enforcement find? They found a serrated knife that had been taken right by the bedstead, right where he slept. Serrated knife taken from Pogue. What else did they find? A little Dremel tool that was used for woodworking that Pogue's father had owned. Right there. He liked it. He didn't know how to use it. He was fascinated with it, like a little creature. Kept it in his backpack in his room. But perhaps the worst thing in the room was this. When this entire saga of death began and they tied him up, what did they tie him up with? Dog leash. Tied this man up with a dog leash. Why would you keep the dog leash? That's the first question. If you're going to get rid of the gun, you think you'd get rid of the dog leash. You think if there was a piece of forensic evidence you didn't want to have hanging around, it'd be that dog leash. They got rid of the blood, got rid of the gun, they got rid of a lot of stuff. Where was the dog leash? Hanging on the inside doorknob of Hoadley's bedroom, weeks and weeks later. Now you think to yourself, this is fairly ghastly so far. So far, so bad. We're just warming up with Hoadley. Because when he gets into jail, where they don't let you take a lot of stuff into jail, and you don't have a lot of room to store a lot of stuff. What's he got? He's got pictures of Pogue's family with him. He's got pictures of himself wearing Pogue's clothes. He's got pictures of himself wearing clothes he took off Pogue. Is this a dark secret for this evil little troll of a human being? No. He shows it to the people in the jail. There's no secret to this. Was any of this in the findings? No. Those findings did nothing but support a decision already made. Now, in fairness to Judge...
Yes, sir. How much of that evidence was presented to the jury in the Hoadley case?
Excuse me?
How much of the evidence you've just described to us was presented in the Hoadley jury trial?
Almost all of it.
That was my
problem. Almost all of it. I'm looking at my... you want an honest set of findings of fact, proposed findings of fact. I submitted findings of fact in this case, 82 paragraphs long, and conclusions of law. And in there, it is cited to each. There's a record cite, not only to Page, but to the line number. And virtually all of this went in front of them. But even if it didn't go in front of them, Judge Zinner, is that determinative under proportionality analysis? The point is, it's in the record. It either went in front of the jury, or he said it. He said it. And yet there is absolutely no attempt by the trial court to balance this. Why? Why? I think in fairness to Judge Warren Johnson, whom I respect and before whom I often appear, that's a tough job. When a man or a woman looks at a 19-year-old boy and says, I'm going to kill you. Not only did he say, I'm going to kill you, he said, I'm going to come watch. Judge Johnson said, I'm going to come watch you die. There is no organization, Supreme Court, legislature, legislative, any branch of government that can tell someone like that, you go back now, you take another look at that, and take the certitude that you had such that you not only want to kill it, but you're going to watch him die and revisit it with an open heart. I think the task was impossible. And that's the only explanation I can come up with for how utterly bereft of anything meaningful these findings are. Second thing to note, obvious from the record, these are not findings of fact and conclusions of law as one would characterize them in law school. They're not the work of a judge at all. This is not the work of a judge who had an enormous and weighty problem before him, who went back into chambers and came out days, months, weeks later with a set of findings of fact and conclusions of law based on his own conclusions. He simply signed off on what John Fitzgerald put in front of him. There are three little additional paragraphs at the end, kind of buff it up, make it look a little bit different. But that's all that is. And I know in typical cases, it's, my gosh, how many times have we all had it happen? Prevailing counsel, would you prepare the findings? But I would have hoped for a little bit better on remand order from this court than a trial court who not only would have simply just signed off on whatever John Fitzgerald put in front of him, but it would have taken, it seems to me, little work for Judge Johnson to have concluded that the LSD frying pan story was a crock. Much is made, much has been made in questions from the bench. Well, he was there. Well, if he was there, why did this LSD frying pan story, which is a complete crock, make its way into findings of fact and conclusions of law? Well, if he was there, why did this Scott Hunter story make its way into findings, and why was there such a gargantuan stretch to put the Scott Hunter story in there? It is not the kind of careful work that one would hope to see on remand, after remand, when the stakes are as high as they are here, death. Judge Zinner, you asked, is there a per se rule that if three people participate in a killing, they all get life? Of course not. But you'll never see another case like this, as long as you live, I hope. It's rare to see a death that takes place over time like this, where all three participants are absolutely morally and factually indistinguishable. You cannot make a meaningful distinction.
2 minutes.
2 minutes now. You can't make a meaningful distinction between these two. You can make fallacial distinctions, but not meaningful distinctions. I got 2 minutes. I want to talk to you about Ring. Justice Gilbertson, you said, is there a per se rule in South Dakota that if you plead guilty, you get life? You know what? I think there is right now for a very short period of time. I think it's only going to apply to Piper and to Page. Here's why. The retroactivity of Ring, Escobedo, Griffith applying Batson retroactively. There are a host of cases which make plain that Ring will be retroactive. To the extent it is retroactive, it'll apply only to those cases on direct appeal. That'll be only these two cases. In South Dakota, you can't get there from here. If you plead, you can't get to a jury trial on those factors. I think it was Justice Zinner, I think so, I was writing, I think you said, well, did anybody object? I objected. Sometimes I'm like Brendan Sullivan's potted plant in these proceedings, but if you go back to page 6 of the change of plea, I specifically noted 23A-27A-6. It was pointed out to the court. The court's offer of a jury trial is wholly illusory. As powerful as he might be and as powerful as you might be, he simply didn't have the power to do that, any more than he could have offered him a trial at the, he could have waived the right to a trial at The Hague. Appear before the world court wouldn't have made any difference. Judge Johnson didn't have the right to offer that. Judge Johnson didn't have the right to create out of whole cloth the right to a jury trial in this case. And so for a short period of time until the legislature addresses this, I believe, I think that if you come forward in a murder case like this, capital murder case, plead guilty, for these two, Ring's gonna get your life. And it should. And it should. And it should. Because we all know. I hate to make these arguments like common sense, but when these statutes were passed And for how many years, how many decades has every practitioner in South Dakota supposed that if you came forward and not only pled, but pled and begged and were 19 years old when you committed the crime, that you wouldn't get life?
If your time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you very
much. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes and would advise the audience that the next hearing will also be an extended period of time of an hour and a half. We're in recess.